Good morning. This is Focus 580, our morning telephone talk show. My name is Jack Brighton. Glad you could listen today. During this hour of Focus 580, we will talk about energy and environmental sustainability on the campus of the University of Illinois. Our guest, Bill Sullivan, he's director of the Environmental Council. He's also associate professor of natural resources and environmental sciences here at the University of Illinois. And he'll be speaking at the University YMCA Friday Forum series. This is a lecture that occurs every Friday during the semesters at the University Y, which is 1001 South Wright Street in Champaign. The Friday Forum series is free and open to the public. They serve a very nice Thai lunch there, by the way. And you are welcome if you want to hear more from Bill Sullivan to attend that lecture today. It starts about 12:15. Meanwhile, we have him with us during this hour of Focus 580, and we'll talk with him and also welcome your questions on the topic. All you have to do is pick up the telephone, the phone number around Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line anywhere you can hear us outside the 217 area code. You can use that. We'll pay for the call, 800-222-9455. And to you, Bill Sullivan, thanks so much for being here.
Good morning, Jack. Nice to be here.
Well, just to kind of kick things off, I know that you've been involved in the issue of energy sustainability, environmental policy on the campus for a long time. It has been something that has been a focus here for a long time.
It sure has. A couple of years ago, the chancellor appointed a committee to address issues of sustainability on campus, and that committee is under John Braden's leadership produced a very important report in 2002, I believe, that laid out an agenda for moving towards sustainability. And I've been on that committee since the year after that, and we've been pushing ahead.
What are the kind of issues that, you know, talk about that? What are some things you've been discussing, you know, in terms of approaching the sustainability on campus?
Well, sustainability on campus can be divided into several domains, one of the most important of which right now is energy conservation and energy use, finding ways to use alternative fuels, for instance, and using less of the energy that we have available to us right now. We're kind of tackling that in a variety of ways. One of the things that we've done as a campus is to make a commitment to build the next big building that we're building. The College of Business's new building is a gold-rated LEED building. LEED stands for Leadership in Energy and Environment and Energy Design.
Mm-hmm.
This new building is going to be the first business college in the country that's designed to a level of sustainability that's significantly beyond anything that's been done before. It's going to use about 75% less energy than some of the older buildings on campus, and it'll use about 40% less energy than this building right here or comparable buildings that are newer. So one of the things that we've done has been help kind of promote that agenda, and it's very exciting to be having such an important new building, a $60 million building,
mm-hmm.
that will be a real landmark on campus. And I think from here on out, we won't be building buildings without a great deal of attention to the energy consumption, the design of systems that reduce energy consumption.
How do you go about that? Because it seems like when you're talking about buildings, and these are obviously, you know, the University of Illinois has, you know, a large set of buildings and the large consumption of energy that goes into those things for heating, lighting, cooling. It would seem to be a sort of an interdisciplinary problem. And, you know, you have to involve the architects, but there's also a lot of other people involved.
That's true. And I think one of the problems in design in the past is that we've had a lot of members of various disciplines share their ideas about how a building should be designed. Mm-hmm. And oftentimes what happens is that you design heating and cooling systems, for instance, to be larger and more powerful than is actually necessary. And there's kind of a sequence of events that has happened in the past in which someone will specify this level of HVA system, heating and air conditioning system, and the person that puts their engineering stamp on it just bumps it up a little, maybe 6 or 8 or 10% just to make sure that it's adequate. And then
right.
when the final, by the time it finally gets done, it may be 10 to 12 to 15% or 20% larger and more powerful than it actually needs to be. Well, over the course of the life of that system, that's going to translate into many thousands of dollars of energy expenses that really didn't need to happen. And another problem is that these kinds of systems have traditionally been designed in a way that doesn't take advantage of the integration between engineering and architecture, mm-hmm. for instance. And that's changing in a very positive fashion so that we can actually think about the kind of windows and the window designs that we're using and the masonry and the HVAC systems, the heating and air conditioning systems, design them as a unit. In doing so, we can take advantage of the savings from the masonry, for instance, the heat savings from the masonry or the amount of glazing or glass we have on a building, and design a heating and cooling system that's really targeted to the specifics of that particular building.
When things are, say, over-designed, or say the heating and cooling systems are maybe too big, you know, for the space that you're talking about, what's the effect of that? I mean, does it actually use more energy? I understand, especially with air conditioning, you want to actually undersize things a little bit because then it'll run consistently instead, you know, continuously and at a more efficient level than if it's, you know, clicking off and on all the time.
That's my understanding, is that it's a larger system is going to end up costing a little bit more over, or significantly more over time. And then you also have the initial expense of buying a larger system as well.
Yeah. Are there also some issues with regard to how those systems are controlled that have to be carefully considered when you're doing this kind of design work?
Well, certainly you want a lot of feedback, and the kinds of technologies that are now available provide more sophisticated feedback than the old-style thermostats that we had in the past. And there's been some movement towards saving energy by putting in movement sensors in rooms so that the sensors will sense when there's no movement in the room and turn the lights off. These have been proven somewhat effective. Some academics don't like them because they'll sit and think for a few moments and suddenly the lights will go off. And the problem with that is that if a person gets frustrated with a system like that, they'll find a way to defeat it.
Mm-hmm.
And in defeating it, that may mean that the lights stay on all the time.
Right. Yeah, putting something in motion in the room that would cause the lights to stay on.
Right.
We have a caller to get to, and I promise I'll get right to them. I was just going to mention that I was down in actually Mexico celebrating a 20th anniversary with my wife, and the hotel there was set up so that when you walk in the hotel room, you have to put your key, a little plastic strip that is, you know, has a magnetic strip on it, into a slot, and if you don't do that, the lights won't turn on. And so when you leave the room, you have to remove the key and the lights and the air conditioning go off.
Oh,
I thought that was a very simple and clever way to sort of manage that.
Yeah, that's very nice. And I think many of the advances that are going to happen in the future are going to be kind of a combination between technology and advances in technology, coupling that with human behavior so that human participation in these technological systems is going to matter, and I think will, in the long run, ensure that the systems will actually work. So that's a lovely solution. I hadn't heard about that before.
We have a caller to talk with. Let's do that. Someone in Urbana, line number one. Good morning.
Hello.
Mm-hmm.
My question is about the stadium, and they have games there where they have this monumental amount of lights, which is taking a monumental amount of energy. And I'd like to know why they can't have games there in the daylight and save all that. Does our university even think about that as being wasteful as it is?
Well, you have any thoughts about that?
That's an interesting question. I would say that the consideration of whether or not to have a nighttime game is largely based on the weather, the time of year. So, we'll more likely have a home game in the evening during August or September, and whether or not a television audience is available.
Yeah.
And my guess is, without having checked this, that it never occurs to the folks in the who schedule the football games, whether or not they'll be using lights or not. I think it's just not on their radar at all.
Well, can you, as a person who's interested in this conservation, get that information into their heads?
We're trying. We've made comments about the lights being on in the stadium during bright daylight hours.
Yeah.
We're not sure. Yeah. We're not sure why that is. That happens at the baseball stadium as well. We're not sure if that's some testing they're doing or why those enormous lights are on during daylight hours. But we've made some suggestions to Jack Dempsey, who's the head of facilities and services, and his people control or participate in controlling some of those lighting issues. We've also made comments about lights being on in parking garages during the daytime when it's bright enough where those lights don't need to be on. I think you raise a good question, and I think the issue is that there are probably many, many dozens, if not hundreds of ways that we can save considerable amounts of energy on campus by being a little bit more planful and making decisions about how we're going to spend our energy bill.
Well, it certainly seems that the university just throws away money without a thought. And so I surely hope that you will be an inspiration to the university to cut down on their energy use. So thank you.
Well, thank you. I think it's the current energy budget that we've got right now is sizable enough where it's really attracting a lot of attention, and there's a lot of motivation to conserve.
Well, the human factors would seem to be, you know, pretty difficult to overcome in many cases. As you know, I think you're speculating that it's not on people's radar that the lights are on or whatever, and it probably isn't. I think that's probably a valid speculation. And I know there are a lot of buildings, if you drive around campus at night, where the lights just they stay on all night, even if nobody's in there. And that's probably true throughout, you know, any city, in fact, has tons of lights on that don't need to be. And nobody thinks, well, you know, what's the way that we're going to manage this, in a way that's either automated or facilitated by easy controls of the lighting. And we're just burning electricity and energy and dollars in the process.
Yeah, and I think it's the time has come where we can't afford that. We can't afford it as an institution because the cost of energy is so high right now. And we can't afford it as a society either because the fact of global warming, it's upon us. And we need to make some decisions about how we're going to live in the world such that we don't exacerbate that problem and actually draw back from it considerably. And one of the ways that we can do that is we can be smarter about how we use energy within our buildings. You know, right now, if I want to go into my building at 2 in the morning and the lights are on in all the hallways. It's very illuminated, and the heating system is up and running, keeping a constant temperature of 70 or 72 degrees in my office all night long. And I would never have it like that at my house.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I set it back at night, and I turn the lights off at night. And I think we need to be engaged in a conversation about how we do that and when it's appropriate to do that, or maybe differently, when it's appropriate not to do that. So if a faculty member has an experiment going on all night long for 2 or 3 or 5 weeks, perhaps that's a period of time in which they get special dispensation and the heating doesn't get set back in the wintertime at night. But other than that, I think we should be engaged in a discussion about setting back these systems. And if that means that we're going to have fewer choices about where to go in the middle of the night for undergraduate students who want to read all night long, well, okay, so be it. These are some choices that I think that we need to make.
We have another caller waiting on a cell phone on line number 4. Let me just mention again, we're talking with Bill Sullivan. He's director of the Environmental Council at the University of Illinois here in Urbana-Champaign, speaking on the issue of energy sustainability on this campus and in general. He is also speaking at the University YMCA Friday Forum lecture at noon today. And we also invite your questions for him during the remainder of this hour. 333-9455 around Champaign-Urbana. Toll-free elsewhere, 800-222-9455. Someone on a cell phone, line number 4. Good morning.
Hi. I was wondering if there might be a possibility, since we have an excellent engineering school, that we could develop scholarship specifically to address this particular situation in the campus, designing either innovative systems that would conserve energy on campus that could be used as models for other situations, or other majors that could get into and evaluate where our perhaps like accountants that could evaluate where the money is going in these particular areas. I just think that there seems to be so much intelligence on board in the community that it would make sense to me to tap that and to use this newfound either information that they could identify or new systems that they could apply to save a lot of energy and a lot of cost in many different areas.
Well, I really appreciate that comment, and if you send me your email address, I'll come and approach you for the first contribution to such a fund, both financially and in terms of your good ideas. Actually, the Environmental Council on campus is working very hard to promote a program called the Living Learning Laboratory for Environmental Sustainability. It's our idea that we should treat the entire campus as a testing ground for how we're going to have to live in the coming decades with respect to the design of the place, its management, how we procure goods and services, where we get our food from, how we deal with water on campus, the kinds of energy resources that we use, our activities with respect to energy conservation. And all of these issues have the various components that a land-grant institution is really designed to address. They have important teaching opportunities. They have really critical research opportunities because we don't have the answers to all these questions yet. And the fact is they're really important for public engagement because the entire society is going to have to grapple with how we're going to use less energy and how we're going to promote equitable growth across the economy at the same time that we preserve the ecosystems that support life on Earth. So I think you're exactly right. We need to, and it's our intention in the Environmental Council to configure the campus as a learning laboratory, a living learning laboratory that allows us to explore and experiment to test and measure our progress with respect to making changes that are more, that are fundamentally sustainable.
Well, also in addition, that if there was maybe your particular organization could get into the area where they looked for funding for gifts and instead of big donations to the sporting department, maybe they could have a special segment that they could advertise in your behalf to offer scholarships or offer money to enhance this program.
Well, that's a lovely idea. I really appreciate that. In fact, the chancellor has just allowed us to hire a development officer, Jeffrey Corson, and working with Jeffrey, we are developing a plan and an agenda for going to the public, going to foundations and corporations, to individuals, to alumni, to actually raise the financial capital that it will help support these kinds of ideas.
Well, I think you got a great idea, and I think the environment is a perfect place to develop new ideas, new situations, and new techniques to save money, because I can't foresee in the future that we're going to this is not a good possibility. I mean, this is definitely a good possibility that we're going to have to squeeze our belts.
Okay.
Thanks a lot.
Thanks so much for the call. We have another caller waiting, and I want to get right to them. I just wanted to follow up on, you know, this idea that as a society we have to figure out how we're going to use less energy, and it strikes me that we haven't yet, as a society, made the commitment to doing that. That we're still thinking that we can go on and continue as we have been in business as usual. And gee, the price of gas is down again, you know, which is great. So I have to worry about buying a car that uses less gas, as we were thinking, well, if it's going to stay up around $3 a gallon, then maybe we'll do that. It's down to, you know, $2.39 now, you know, or just as a sort of trivial example of the kind of, I think that is something we're still, as a society, unable to quite grasp that we have to use less?
Well, I think there's two mechanisms by which I think we're going to move in this direction. One would be the price of fossil fuels, and in the long run, they're definitely going to go up. You know, we're having a downtrend now compared to where we have been, but the long trend is very clear. It's going to go back up. And the second issue is going to touch us all in really profound ways, and that is climate change. I said earlier that I believe climate change is on us. The science on this is undisputable, and it's very clear. We're in a period of warming right now. The question remains, to what extent have human activities produced that change? But it looks pretty certain that a considerable amount of the change is attributable to the greenhouse gases that we put in the atmosphere from burning fossil fuels. And so I think as a society, we're going to come to grips with that. And we're going to do so because of the activities of former Vice President Al Gore and his movie, The Inconvenient Truth, for instance, and the fact that a number of nonprofit organizations and scientific organizations are lobbying very aggressively to keep the question of global climate change on the table. There are two bills in Congress right now, one in the House and one in the Senate, that actually pose incentives and require changes in an effort to dramatically reduce greenhouse gas production in the coming 3 or 4 decades. Those are there right now because public consciousness is changing and we're starting to pay more and more attention to this. And boy, almost every week you hear of a new example of issues related to warming, global warming, and they are profound. And they will change the face of the earth in really dramatic ways. And we have a limited amount of time. The window of opportunity for us to scale back the amount of carbon dioxide and methane and other gases that we're putting into the atmosphere is relatively narrow. We need to take action. We need to take action soon. And I think more and more people are going to come to realize that, because it's going to affect not only their lives, but in very, very profound ways, the lives of their children and grandchildren.
We're almost in our midpoint here. We're talking with Bill Sullivan. He's director of the Environmental Council at the University of Illinois, also associate professor of natural resources and environmental sciences here, speaking at the University Y Friday Forum lecture at noon, and we've got him with us for the next half hour. A couple callers waiting. Others are welcome. 333-9455 around Champaign-Urbana. Toll-free elsewhere, 800-222-9455. Let's go on and speak with some more listeners. Someone in Urbana on line number one. Good morning.
Hi. In the new business building, well, let me back up a little bit. When I've been in like some Amish businesses that aren't using electricity, they've got these, I don't know, light wells or something going on where they're bringing light from the roof down into some of the darker interior parts of the stores. Is anything like that going into the new business building? Bring in interior light?
That's an excellent question. I think there's going to be a considerable amount of interior light, but it's all going to come from the glass on the windows, on the vertical portions of the building. And there's two reasons for that. One reason is that a portion of the roof is going to be covered by a green material. It'll actually be a green roof, a living roof. And a major portion of the roof will be covered by photovoltaic cells, the solar panels that will actually produce about 7% of the energy that the building will use. So that's one reason that they haven't done that. Another reason that they have chosen not to do that is because the energy that you save by having the direct sunlight come into this space, and the sunlight from those light tubes, especially if they're mirrored, you can put a tube up through up to the roof, and if it's mirrored, you really get a very nice amount of sunlight to come in. The problem with those is that you lose a lot of heat through the lack of insulation that's there. So it's a wash with respect to the amount of energy that you save, or it may even cost you with respect to energy, depending on where you are. In warmer climates, you're probably fine.
Well, the other issue with passive solar, the windows and so forth, is in the summer, of course, you get more solar gain than you really want. So you, there's a trade-off there as well.
Right. If the windows are designed appropriately with the right overhang and facing the right direction, I think you can, through good architectural design, you can avoid that.
Okay. Well, I want to follow up on some of these. Well, maybe talk more about that building and other things, but let's go next to another Champaign listener on line number two. Good morning.
Hello. I was wondering, you're talking about the university as kind of a model of the community in 5-10 years. I'm curious as of your plans for it as a resource for the community, and ideally in the next couple of years for people who would like to, you know, try to set up passive solar in their house simply by adding, you know, like boxes with glass on them. Simple projects, complicated projects. Do you see the university taking on a role like that, and how soon?
Is your question whether or not the university would provide technical assistance to do that?
Bingo, exactly. Or yes, do they have any plans? Because if it's just the university, there's still no professional help or very little information even for people who would like to, you know, do this on their own.
Mm-hmm.
A percentage of people in Champaign-Urbana right now who are doing anything related to solar energy. And that's ridiculous, but I think a huge part of it is that there just aren't the resources that make it available to people.
Well, there's a very exciting new grant that Professor Brian Deal and his colleagues have won to provide technical assistance with respect to a whole host of energy-related issues for small businesses, and I would imagine that they would be happy to communicate with homeowners as well. And they've got a grant from the state of Illinois that will run multiple years and will set them up as the key place in the state to provide energy-related assistance in terms of design and redesign, reconfiguration of energy systems. So his name is Brian Deal, and I'm sure you can find him on campus. He's a professor in, I don't know if he's in architecture or urban planning.
Okay, that's enough. Thanks a lot.
Okay, thanks for the call. Another Champaign listener next on line number one. Good morning.
Hi. Yes. As you're looking at campus activities, we have one of the only institutions that provides railroad engineering. Railroad traffic is up like crazy, and we need railroaders, we need railroad researchers, and we need railroad operators, and traffic's up by about a third. Some rail trains can go a ton of freight, lightweight freight, 400 miles on a gallon of diesel, and they can take up to 280 semi-trailers on bogies and redistribute them on prime movers when they get to the destination and have that convenient. But it takes a lot of traffic off the road, and I think that if you're looking at campus activities, I would look strongly at railroad engineering. But I got a couple of other questions. One of the environmental problems with universities is that universities do better with pure research, and they do better with nice, neat, tidy packages. The problem of promotion of people who have several disciplines at once is real, and so as we go into an era of allowing artists to work with engineers, for instance, the question of who promotes and how do you do that? I think that that's a major block in all interdisciplinary studies.
Interesting question.
It's an interesting and important question.
Yeah.
Because I think that this man is right. Many of the most interesting and important problems that society faces today are messy. They're not neat disciplinary problems that only a structural engineer or only a landscape architect is going to be able to produce solutions for. We're going to need the creativity and ingenuity and energy and passion of people from multiple disciplines to come together. And this caller is right that the tenure and promotion process is largely based on you being a star, Jack, and we'll get you'll get to be a promoted tenured professor as long as you can show that you're a star. And And I think that it's my sense that Provost Katehi and Vice Provost Ruth Watkins and many of the deans understand the challenge of this, both that the problems are messy and our approach to solving them really needs to be increasingly multidisciplinary. And I think we're working real hard on figuring out how to change the promotion and tenure system, the reward system, to adapt to that new reality. One of the exciting points about this is that we're being pushed in another direction as well, and that is that many of the biggest grants that we can get from the federal government, especially the National Science Foundation and to a large extent the National Institutes for Health, require teams of people from different disciplines. And it's not just, you know, we just don't have a token engineer or a token designer or a token social scientist. They need to be, the more successful grant applications are the ones with integrated teams. So there's a real push from the funding agencies to grapple with these messy problems and mm-hmm. to require interdisciplinary teams.
I want to back up and sort of ask you to talk a bit more about the process of developing this. There is now a plan. I don't know to what extent this plan is formal in terms of campus sustainability, but you know, this is something you've been working on for a long time, and maybe you could also talk about the work of the Environmental Council as it relates to this. But I guess I'm curious as to your take on going forward, what is going to be the process for dealing with sustainability in terms of energy on campus?
Yeah, that's a good question, Jack. Let me first of all say it's not settled.
Yeah.
And let me be clear about that, we don't have a green light from the provost or the chancellor on the exact plan. But it's also very clear that we're going to have an initiative on this campus, actually university-wide, dealing with energy and sustainability. And the form that takes has not been hammered out. And we've got ideas on the table, mm-hmm. and we're energetic and enthusiastically promoting those. But we need to see what kind of resources are available. And Ruth Watkins, the vice provost, and Linda Katay, the provost, need to get together with Chip Zukowski and make some decisions about exactly how we're going to proceed. So the long answer to that mm-hmm. question is it's not quite clear.
Yeah.
But boy, we're enthusiastic and very ready to move. And the methodology that we have in mind is to conceive of the entire campus as a learning laboratory for environmental sustainability, and to ask very serious questions about our procurement procedures. Where do we get the things that we buy for campus? We currently don't require ourselves to buy Energy Star appliances. And, you know, for the person that has a grant and needs to buy some type of fancy freezer to keep samples at some very cold temperature, I'm sure that they probably just look at the performance of the unit and the price of the unit and get the best unit that they can for the price. And I think increasingly we need to figure out a way to say, well, we need that to be we need to have energy factored into that, because although the grant, scientist's grant may pay for the refrigerator, the campus and the citizens of the state of Illinois will spend many years paying for the energy that goes into that. Mm-hmm. So we need to explore what it's going to take as an institution to change our patterns of purchasing and to do so with respect to energy in mind. We're going to do the same thing with regard to the design of the campus buildings and the campus landscape. And we're going to do so in a way that engages the undergraduate and graduate students on campus and really use the design of the place as an opportunity to learn about design mm-hmm. and to explore alternative patterns of design that relate to ecological processes, so that we not only have designs that are more appropriate for this place, but that we can actually go outside and look at how those processes actually work right here on our campus. There's a host of opportunities like that.
We have just about 15 minutes left with our guest, Bill Sullivan, director of the Environmental Council here at the University of Illinois, talking about energy sustainability. A couple of callers waiting, and we'll go on and talk with them. Someone in Champaign next on line number one. Good morning.
Yeah, you were talking about the integration. It would seem to me that the Beckman Institute would certainly be a model for, you know, the bringing various disciplines together, you know, that kind of thing. Maybe the same thing should be done in the environmental area.
That's a great idea.
You know, I mean, it's a wonderful model because, you know, they're a professor of this particular area, but they're also over at the Beckman Institute. So maybe, you know, somebody want a, you know, big grant to yeah. Establish this, the same thing in your area.
Yeah, that's a lovely idea.
Okay.
Thanks for the call. Another Champagne listener next on line number two. Good morning.
I wanted to say that last week we had the past president from Sierra Club here, and he was explaining to us that the term climate change has been very sanitizing. It's been used politically instead of global warming because it tends to put the blame on sunspots or something beyond our universe and not put the human element into things. So he and Sierra Club generally are encouraging the use of the term global warming rather than climate change.
That's an interesting comment. I personally use climate change because if you look at the models across the globe of what we would expect during climate change, you'll actually see some areas getting colder, considerably colder, and other areas getting considerably warmer. And the colder aspects are going to have enormous impacts. One of the models, or many of the models, suggest that as the Earth gets generally warmer, and the glaciers around the Earth melt, we'll have such an incredible amount of fresh water that enters the oceans that will disrupt the ocean currents very dramatically, and in doing so, will change the temperature of Western Europe by many degrees. It will become many degrees colder. I've decided to use climate change because I feel like it's just a little more accurate.
It is an interesting point, and one could imagine that you know, the rhetoric would be something that would play into people's calculations in the political process of arguing for this or that policy. But it is, in fact, as you say, not just global warming, but changes in rainfall patterns and changes in ocean salinity that affect, you know, various, you know, breeding grounds for various ocean, you know, life forms and so forth, and the food chain. So it's, you know, from what, you know, if you could get into some serious, you know, sort of doomsday scenarios in reading some of the stuff that's coming out. And unfortunately, it's the only planet we have to run this experiment on.
That's right. And for us here in central Illinois, the trend is very clear. The projections that Don Wobbles and Steve Long and other scientists on campus have made suggest that the temperature or the climate that we experience here today will be very similar to the climate that people experience in East Central Texas in 90 or 95 years or so, if things stay as they are. So that, for us, the experience of that would be considerable global warming.
Another caller on campus here on line number three. We'll talk with them next. Good morning. You're on Focus 580.
Hello. I'm calling to offer a counterpoint or maybe a challenge for the suggestion that we use campus as a learning laboratory. The suggestion that the faculty and students should be assigned some task for dealing with a practical problem on campus isn't really the way campuses work.
Oh, I completely agree, and I would never want to suggest that anybody would be assigned that.
An earlier caller suggested that we, you know, hire students to solve the engineering problems on campus and all that. The faculty investigate the questions that are of interest to them, and students explore areas that are interesting to them. Now, perhaps some of the faculty, I would imagine some of the faculty, would be interested in participating, but the idea that this is somehow just get the faculty that work here and treat them as though they're consulting engineers or something is really not a solution. I didn't think that you suggested it, but I thought maybe some of the listeners were leaning in that direction.
Okay, let me address that. I think that's an important clarification to make. Then we hire the best and the brightest people on our campus because we think that having those kind of people are going to help us advance knowledge, produce the best graduates, contribute to the problems that society faces in the most effective way. Having said that, there are ways to attract people to certain problems. And one of the ways to do that is to provide kind of visibility for those problems. And the campus can do that in this case. We can also provide resources or help leverage resources to attract people to certain domains. And I think we'll try and use both of those mechanisms to attract attention. But you're right. Faculty members can and should pursue their passions and do so with vigor. And it would never work on this campus for us to say, Jack, you have to go and work on this. That's just not how we operate.
Absolutely. Well, I appreciate you. I wish you luck with this. I believe you will have success and a lot of interest among the faculty and students.
Thanks for your call.
Bye-bye.
Thanks for the call. We have just about 10 minutes left with Bill Sullivan, Director of the Environmental Council here at the University of Illinois. And I'll mention again that he's speaking at noon, just a very short time from now, at the University YMCA, if we haven't worn him out here. And the Friday Forum lecture there, also the topic, energy sustainability on the University of Illinois campus. I wanted to sort of back up again, I'm always doing that, and sort of ask you to talk a bit about what we mean by sustainability, because it's one of those terms that we kind of throw out there without really saying what it is. What do you mean by sustainability when we talk about the environment and energy?
That's a really good question, and it's a question that engenders considerable debate in academic circles. And it's an important question to address because as long as it stays vague, then it's really difficult to measure our progress towards it. So coming up with clear definitions is, I think, important. And coming up with metrics or guideposts so that we know that we're going in the right direction and that we can measure our progress is also really important. Probably one of the most widely known and widely held definitions of sustainability was advanced by the Brundtland Commission in 1987. That was known at the time as the World Commission on Environment and Development. And they didn't talk about sustainability. They talked about sustainable development. And the definition was that sustainable development was a kind of development that meets the needs of the present generation without compromising the ability of future generations to meet their needs. And so they were saying we got to meet the needs of people today, and we need to do that in a fashion that doesn't affect the ability of future generations to meet their own needs. It kind of calls to mind the idea of the seventh generation philosophy that Native American Iroquois Confederacy used when the chiefs charged each other to bear in mind the effects of their actions today on their descendants for seven generations into the future. So that was the 87 kind of definition that has been floated. And there have been a number of attempts to tweak that and refine it. And in the 1995, the World Summit on Social Development redefined sustainability as a framework for our efforts to achieve higher quality life for all people. So there's a little bit more of a focus on the quality of life in that definition. And they talked about economic development, social development, and environmental protection as being interdependent and mutually reinforcing. So there's we get a little bit more specific there. The 2002 World Summit on Sustainable Development identified three overarching objectives. Eradicating poverty was their first one. The second one was protecting natural resources, and the third was changing unsustainable production and consumption patterns. I just came from a dissertation defense, actually, right before coming here from Rumi Shaman's dissertation in natural resources and environmental sciences, and he had a definition of sustainability. He said that sustainability is ensuring that critical social, economic, and ecological processes are maintained in a way so that both the short and long-term quality of life of human societies and the health and diversity of natural systems are not compromised. And this is the key part to his definition. He also goes on to say that the scale of human activities are kept within the natural caring capacities of the environment. I think that's a really lovely tweak. So what we're seeing from this variety of definitions is a concern for the health and well-being of human beings, the dignity of life, some sense of economic security, and some sense that those goals need to be achieved within the normal carrying capacities of environmental systems. Now, those are pretty broad goals, and the question is, how do we operationalize that at this place in East Central Illinois at this time, and do so in a way that's generalizable to communities way beyond here? Because in fact, it's not just a problem of here; it's a worldwide problem. It's one of the reasons that it's so attractive from an academic or scholarly standpoint is that it's happening right here, right now, and it's got worldwide implications. So we need to figure out how to operationalize that. And one of the ways that we're doing that is to think about how we buy materials and goods and services, the kinds of energy that we use, how do we get an alternative mix of fuels, a renewable mix of fuels or energy-producing sources into our energy portfolio. How do we conserve energy through the design of new buildings, through the renovation of current buildings, through the practices that all of us use in terms of, you know, when we shut off our computers and when we shut off our printers and how we deal with our windows and lighting and whatnot.
And water, too.
And water, that's a big question,
yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
We have just about 5 minutes left during this hour of focus. If someone wants to join us real fast, I'll mention the phone numbers one more time. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. You know, we could talk probably forever about any one of the things that you were just discussing. One of the, you know, speaking of energy, as we started the hour, the University of Illinois has its own power plant, the Abbott Power Plant, which is at this point is a coal-fired plant. Is that correct?
Oh, it uses coal, and
yes.
It's got some huge turbines that burn natural gas.
Okay. And there is an additional component that is being discussed at this point. I don't know where it is, but the wind turbine project, I believe.
Right.
Do you know about that?
I sure do. I've been an active participant in that effort. That grew out of a wonderful effort that the students led, actually. Mm. And the students decided to tax themselves a couple of years ago, $2 per semester per student. And they're putting that money into a pot to be used for renewable energy. And one of the first things that they did with it was to leverage $300,000 of that into a $2 million grant from the Illinois Clean Energy Community Foundation. And they took that $2.3 million to the campus, and the campus decided to pitch in the rest of the money to procure three 1.5 megawatt turbines. Each of those turbines will produce about a little less than 1% of the energy of the electricity that we use on campus. Mm-hmm. Those are we're working with the FAA right now to figure out where we can put those on the South Farms. There's some concern about the flight patterns with respect to Willard Airport, and because they are so tall. Mm. But those we're definitely going to do that. We have the money and the commitment, and we're moving forward with that. I see you have another caller, but I was just going to say, you know, last year we put about £1 billion, just shy of 1 billion pounds of carbon dioxide into the atmosphere. That, whenever I say that to myself, it's just, I feel staggered.
Yeah,
by that.
Exactly. Staggering is the term.
An institution of about, you know, we've got about 50,000 people on campus every day, and we put £1 billion of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. We have got to do better than that, and society needs to do better than that, and this is a wonderful opportunity for us to help pave the way.
We'll squeeze in one last caller here. I guess they disappeared. Well, sorry about that. Made them wait too long. My apologies. As we look ahead, obviously this process is going to continue. We literally only have about 2 minutes left. In terms of what people in the community should perhaps know about the university's commitment to this, is there anything that you want to say, sort of wrap up the discussion here?
Well, I think to wrap up the discussion, I'd say that there are dozens and dozens of really exciting things that we're doing on campus right now, both on campus and I think one of the shining examples is Allerton Park, where David Scable and Brian Deal are doing wonderful things, really kind of pushing the edge of where we're at with respect to sustainability right now. There's a whole lot of exciting activity going on. And in the coming year, it's my hope that as a campus will come together under the president and chancellor's new strategic plan and really make this a signature program. And in doing so, I think that we will really fulfill the land-grant mission in an exciting new way, a way that really speaks to the concerns of our society as we move into the more mature years of this century.
We'll have to stop there since we're out of time, but I will mention again that if you would like to hear more on this topic, our guest, Bill Sullivan, will be speaking at the University YMCA Friday Forum Lecture that is free and open to the public. It's 1001 South Wright Street in Champaign, and that begins at just about 12:15, so you'd have time to get over there. And our guest again, Bill Sullivan, Director of the Environmental Council and Associate Professor of Natural Resources and Environmental Sciences here at the University of Illinois.
Thanks, Jack.
Thank you.
Pleasure to talk to you.